Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking home renovation and repair issues today with Chad Spade of Chad's Carpentry in Madison and Dave Kenyon with the Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation in Madison. Dave, great to have you. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. And Chad, great to see you again as well.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
Dave, maybe tell us a little bit about the Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation to start things out here.
Okay. Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation has been in business for 25, 30 years now. And actually, my working for them, my full job is working with Focus on Energy, a contract that Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation has. And the Focus on Energy program is, of course, the Wisconsin statewide program for energy efficiency and renewable energy. My particular job there has been working with builders and remodelers and trying to figure out solutions.
Yeah, great. Well, I wanted to get that in because I wanted people to know that if there are energy questions, although, Chad, you could answer those questions too, can't you?
That's right. We do a lot of remodeling that focuses on trying to make the home more energy efficient, tighter, better ventilated. And in fact, I recently just did kind of a case study assessment of about a dozen projects that my company has done over the last 4 years. And we found that we're saving homeowners anywhere from 22 to 53% on their energy bills as a result of improvements we make to their homes.
Wow.
So a lot of opportunity out there if you want to reduce your energy bill.
So we can talk about energy, and we can also talk about other home renovation repair issues as well with our two guests. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And let's turn to Steve in Libertyville, Illinois, for our first question. Steve, hello.
Hello, Larry, Dave, and Chad. How are you today?
Good. Thank you.
That's great. I have a gutter installation question for you.
Okay, gutter installation.
Yeah, I had a fella come out here a couple of weeks ago and put new seamless gutters on my house. And the other day I went to check on the flow of the gutters because they were stopped up a little. And I noticed he didn't put outlets on the gutters to connect the downspout to the gutter. He had cut through the gutter, bent back the sheet metal from the gutter and attached with sheet metal screws, and he hadn't sealed it. And I've looked online and think you're supposed to put outlets on there and seal it. And when I talked to this fella about that, he says, oh, nobody does it that way anymore. So I wondered what your fellas.
Okay. Well, Chad, maybe go to you first.
Yeah, as far as I know, there is a little sleeve that is put down inside of that gutter, and then the downspout is attached to that, and that sleeve basically is caulked into the cut opening. It's essentially a connector between the two pieces of, you know, between the gutter and the downspout, and I have to say that I don't think I have ever seen a gutter assembly without it.
Yeah, Dave, you're shaking your head in agreement there.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be this connector has got to be water sealed between the two.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I've seen online. It's called an outlet, and you're supposed to rivet it, and you're supposed to seal it. And this fellow was adamant that that's the way he does all his gutters. And I wondered why it only took a half a day for these guys to do the job, so.
It doesn't take long to put that little sleeve into the gutter. I mean, it's just, it's simple. I mean,
it's a couple of bucks. I went to a hardware store, and I got five of them, and I'm going to do it myself. And I got some caulk, and I just wanted, I've been waiting a week or so. I've been waiting for Larry to have the show so I can ask the expert.
You were right, Steve.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for calling. Good luck,
Larry, and keep up the great work.
All right. Thank you. All right. There's Clay in Lake City, or Lake County, Illinois, next. All right, our first calls are from Illinois. Let's go to Clay. Hi, Clay.
Hi. My question is whether there are any products, small-scale energy generators like a windmill marketed to a single residence type of thing? Like if you were living in the country, are there small enough wind generators to scale to a single residence and to enable you to take your home off the grid, so to speak, so that you could generate your own electrical power?
All right. Well, let's get we'll go to Dave Kenyon for that one. Okay. Dave, hi.
Yes, definitely there are small enough wind generators for residential purposes. I think you're going to have to get someone to help you work on the design of what it can actually do for you, and whether it's exactly where you want to go. I think you need to do some negotiation with, say, a renewable energy person who checks out your site, site assessment, and things like that. I'm hoping that in Illinois you have that that kind of service. I know in Wisconsin, through the Midwest Renewable Energy Association and Focus on Energy, they provide at least they help the consumer get an assessment of the property and the kinds of technologies that might be appropriate for your site.
Yeah. But you need you really do need to do an assessment first to see whether or not there's going to be enough wind there to really generate, make a difference. I mean, we live on a lake, so we get quite a bit of wind. But I mean, I even wonder whether or not we'd have even close to enough. But
the best way to go is to get somebody out to your property and see what's appropriate for that piece, and to see whether or not wind is going to actually be able to fulfill your needs.
Yeah.
So it varies considerably by site as to whether or not you could do that or not.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. There are some interesting new designs for the windmills. In the old propeller types are, you know, everybody knows about, but I see some that are almost like a cylinder, rotating
yes.
cylinder on top, John.
Yeah, it's kind of a cone, or almost like it looks like a helix or something.
Yeah.
Those are being promoted for urban installation because they're thought to be a little safer with respect to birds, and they also don't have the kind of sight line issues or the, you know, because a lot of times those windmills, they're pretty big, and people don't want to see them in their neighborhood. So.
Yeah. Well, I know there's one in Fitchburg that's operating in the neighborhood, part of their community program, and it's pretty silent and fairly unobtrusive, actually. But those are all pretty expensive, and the payback on them is really difficult for a single-family home owner. Mm-hmm. Paul in East Troy, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Paul.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a repair issue for our roof. This winter, we had a pretty severe ice dam in one of the valleys, and with a thaw and some rain and so on, we started getting some water into the house. So I kind of panicked and went up and blasted away with a hammer and actually at one point a chisel, and I was able to get the ice dam broken off and so on. I think you know where this is going. Stop the water coming into the house, which was my most important thing. Now I'm left with some pretty nice-looking holes in the shingles. Yeah, I know, it's stupid, but gee, I didn't know quite what to do. It was 3:00 in the morning, and here I was anyway. My question is, first of all, the roof, it's a second layer on top, and it's only the top layer that's been damaged. But my question is, how much of a project is it to replace those shingles, or am I stuck with a major repair getting that, it's a fairly small, but that portion of the roof fixed? And then I have a second question after that regarding those heat rods or whatever that I've seen put on valleys of roofs to help try to prevent ice dams, whether or not you think that's a good idea.
Okay.
Well, I think I can address all of this. First off, I would say that you might want to consider, I would definitely consider trying to air seal the home in the vicinity of the ice dam so that the ice dam itself is not going to be coming back to cause problems in future years. And it could be that since you're going to have to repair the roof there anyway, that it'll make sense to kind of, you know, take the roof apart in that area and then do some foaming and caulking and sealing and insulating in that vicinity to reduce the potential for the problem to happen again. Then if you're not going to be significantly tearing apart the shingles to repair the roof, you might be able to get at it from the attic side of the home. But then once you put it all back together, you'll have an opportunity to put in some ice and water shield on the eave, which is generally a good practice to have as the underlayment. But that, too, is more of a, that's treating the symptom rather than fixing the cause of it. Now, heat tape, which is your second question, is something that we'll put up on a roof where we have problem ice dams, and we want to encourage that ice not to form and allow it to melt and flow down the tape to the ground. But if possible, you know, that's there are situations where you have to use it just because of a combination of roof design and where the sun shines and a variety of other factors. But if you can avoid it, it's generally the last resort, but it is a way to deal with the problem in the future. And, you know, frankly, it's better to put the heat tape up than it is to pull out the chisel and the hammer, because the heat tape can be placed over the ice dam and it can melt its way down and then allow the water to get off the roof. So,
all right, there you have it. Let's turn to Larry in Madison next. Larry, hello to you.
Thank you. I have questions about attic insulation.
Okay.
Referring to a 30-year-old ranch house that is in excellent condition, the present insulation in the attic is batting between the joists. These are not thick bats. I know that it needs a great deal more insulation on these bats. My first question is, should I have another layer of batting installed, or should I have insulation blown in on top of the batting? And do you want the second question now?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I understand that it could be important to seal any air leaks in the attic. And my question is, how much do I need a specialist just for sealing air leaks, or can any competent insulator who's been in the business a while seal those leaks if there are any?
Okay. All right.
Start her out there, Chad.
I would say that, unfortunately, a lot of insulation contractors don't understand the concept of air sealing. And I mean no disrespect to the industry, but I know as a remodeling contractor that, you know, we've had a number of insulation contractors over the year say, oh, yeah, we will air seal. And then they don't know what, you know, they're just trying to appease us. But then if you participate in the home performance program, which I strongly recommend for you to help you deal with your improvement, they will test your house prior to the improvement, and then they'll come back at the end and test it to see what has actually been accomplished. So that will give you verification, and then I would encourage you to find an insulation contractor who uses a blower door while they are air sealing your house. And so that is a way that you know that, one, the insulator understands what air sealing is, and they are committed to it enough that they're going to use the diagnostic tool that they need to use to make sure that they are actually sealing up your home. Once that is done, then it's okay to insulate. And I would encourage you just to put blown insulation over top of the batting, because it will fall into all the little nooks and crannies where currently air is flowing around those bats. And it's really a better way to insulate once you have air sealed. But the insulation alone will not air seal the home. And if air is flowing through the ceiling or through the wall plate caps, it will continue to flow up and down through the insulation. And you'll probably see evidence of that in the attic. Along the top of wall plates, you'll see dark spots in the fiberglass. And that's actually dirt and dust that's being captured by what we like to call filter glass, or it's actually fiberglass, but it's also a filter, and it filters that air while it's moving through your walls. Another tool that will essentially show that, in fact, you either have leaks or don't would be infrared imaging that a home performance evaluator will use, and they can show you how that heat or lack of heat is present in your partition walls.
There you have. Okay. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Dave, you were going to add
to
that.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that a little bit. One of the things the Home Performance with Energy Star consultants are doing at this point in the program is doing is working with insulators in terms of how to air seal. Mm-hmm. And in order to be recognized as an ally, an installing ally, with the Home Performance with Energy Star program, these folks have to have had some training now, and they understand the issues better. The industry itself has never done this before, mm-hmm. and so it's a great improvement, because we all know that air movement is a thief of our heat.
So contractors who would be listed then on the site?
Listed on the website with focus on energy.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Chad Spade of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, Dave Kenyon of the Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation, our guest here today. Dave Potratz, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question about home renovation, repair, or an energy issue with your home, I hope you'll join in as we visit with Chad Spade and Dave Kenyon. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Eric in Superior next. Eric, hello.
Hi. This is kind of a comment and sort of a question also with regard to the Energy Star program. The things that are made available, according to what I've been told when I ask various sources, including the Energy Star rep that did the blower door test on my own home on one occasion. I think that some of the support for the rebates or benefits available to people are tax dollar supported. And it seems to be difficult to find out how those things can be channeled to people who might make improvements to their own homes. Now, I realize it's a difficult thing in the case of what you just addressed with regard to insulation and the expertise necessary to understand, you know, how you're going to get in and air seal those areas, et cetera. So you want these contractors to be certified. But in my own case, something as simple as changing out a gas furnace to a high-efficiency gas furnace, the rebate that's made available through Energy Star, and this was a few years ago, and I don't know if the program continues in the same way or if it comes back periodically, but that rebate isn't available to someone who does the work themselves when, you know, all you're doing is reconnecting the gas line, pressure testing that, possibly getting a new plenum made up, and, you know, wiring the new furnace in there. So it seems to be something that possibly could be addressed. I've run into the same thing now. I'm building a new home, and the federal government, I understand, has a program where if you go to renewable energy, you can get a tax rebate, but you have to have a certified installer. So if you're going to do this yourself to save money, those things aren't available to you. And I work as a building inspector, and I have seen on furnace changeouts that when those programs are available, the prices for those that work goes up. So I think those rebates are not ending up in the pockets of the homeowner. Of course, they are getting the long-term benefits of the energy saving on their heating bills. That's just a comment. I don't know if there's any place that information can go, but
Well, I appreciate
what it's worth.
Yeah, I appreciate the comment. Let's get a response from Dave Kenya. Dave.
I'll try and give my response. The incentives and rebates from Focus on Energy for equipment, I believe it can only go through the installing contractor, but the incentive is supposed to end up with the end user, meaning the homeowner. I cannot tell you right offhand, because I don't work in that equipment program, whether or not the piece of equipment must be installed by a certified installer. I think that's the case, but I'm not sure about the self-installs and how the program works with that.
Okay.
I would strongly suggest that the caller call the 800 number of Focus on Energy and find out exactly how self-installs work, and that's 1-800-762-7077.
1-800-762-7077. Okay. Chad, anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, the caller is making a good point, and it's always a difficult decision, I think, for policymakers when they're offering up money to decide, are there going to be standards for this, which is what leads us to put those sorts of restrictions on the rebate, versus are we just going to give the money away with some receipts, which is essentially what the new federal energy tax credit allows for things like insulation and window replacement. All you have to do there is show your receipt for the product, and then you get the tax rebate. Well, you haven't necessarily lowered your energy bill, which is the goal of the program.
Right.
And so it is a difficult choice. And personally, as a professional who sees a lot of shoddy work done by, frankly, professionals, I think that it's important to have some type of verification. The nice thing about the home performance program is that when you do pay for that home performance with Energy Star evaluation, but then the homeowner can do most of those improvements, and then the evaluator comes back to do a verification and to do the post-test, and to at least there is that kind of oversight. And then the money is given. So I think in some respects that program serves as a very good model, because it has some verification without imposing on who does it.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Just a thought.
There you have it, Eric.
Can I follow up on that?
Go ahead.
Yeah, since the verification is available through Energy Star, and I applaud that with the blower door test and, you know, before and after and all of that, that in itself seems to provide, you know, sufficient oversight if a person were to want to do the work themselves. And you mentioned maybe they can, and maybe the program has changed, whereby that is those kinds of follow-up are what is necessary, and the performance is the criteria for receiving the benefit. And that's really the way that I think it should be. But I think with regard to the equipment efficiency rebates, et cetera, I don't think that is available. I think that the homeowner is not able to do that themselves. If Energy Star has people who come out beforehand and they're verifying that, yes, this is an older model inefficient furnace, so the home does qualify for the program, that person could, you know, quite easily come back and say, I do see that the new one has been installed. I don't see anything incorrect about the installation, and they should get the rebate. It would be nice if it worked that way.
Well, and, you know, you're a licensed home inspector, Eric, and probably have a lot, may have more skills than, certainly have more skills than I have. I know that for a fact, and probably certainly more skills than the average person has. And I would be the last one to want to reinstall my own furnace, or a new furnace, for example. I'd want somebody else, and probably most people are in that same boat. But you make some good points. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. John in Mondovi, we will turn to you next. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. Enjoying the program here. I have a little bit different kind of a question, not having to do with insulation, but The end result of what happened to me is blew out my my oil furnace. It's the situation in a late April snowstorm. We'll get a foot and a half of snow, and the next day it goes up to 75, and the majority of the surface water winds up in my basement. I'm wondering, I'm trying to do some sloping things, putting things in the ground like this black plastic pipe with holes on the top so that the water funnels in a certain direction and goes around the house rather than through it. Can you give me any idea as to what I should do? Let me additionally say the water table here is fairly high at times. When we have a good rain, I might have just a quarter an inch of water in one part of the basement. But I'm wondering if I'm being wise. I don't know if I'm drawing a proper picture, but getting some water directed to a certain area from two directions, and then so that it can bypass. I'm going to dig into the ground and get it to bypass the house. Is there such a thing as success in an area like this when, for instance, I use the black pipe with holes on the top? Would that be something I should consider, or should I? Do I need something a little bit harder than the black 4-inch flexible pipe?
John, okay. Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, I was going to say, John, the biggest thing is, like you're doing, is to get that surface water running away from the house or around the house. So if you have, say, the top of your foundation right at grade, you need to get swales going away from the house. In other words, basically, yeah, away from the house and then around the house to get all that surface water so it doesn't get close to your foundation. And that's a little bit different than a high water table. If it was from a high water table, you'd see it creeping up from the bottom or from your slab. So there is sort of two different things to consider there.
Yeah. Chad, anything?
Yeah, I would just add that if the landscaping alterations that you're contemplating don't fix the problem, and I would agree with Dave that the swale is an important way to go, or it might be a good idea, keeping it up on the surface, then you could look into an interior drain tile and sump pump to mitigate the water that's otherwise collecting on the basement floor, because it's not good to have that happening consistently, and that would be the way to solve that. But then, of course, once you pump that water back outside, it has to get away from the foundation. You don't want a loop that where the water is just getting pumped back and coming back in.
Okay. So. Can you give me an idea on the flexible black 4-inch flexible black pipe with the holes on the top? Is that reasonable? I'll put a couple of inches, and I'll put it down into the ground a little bit so that I can mow over it and so forth. But if you think that would be a possible solution, it's about 50 feet from one direction and about 50 feet from another direction. It would come in like a V.
Okay. Well, what do you think?
You know, I'm going to recommend if you can, if you're going to have relatively straight lines for these buried drain tiles, I would recommend working with the smooth surfaced rigid piping, because what happens a lot of times with those corrugated pipes is that there's a lot of resistance inside the pipe every time the water is passing over it, and so debris will build up. It is hard to clean those out, and if they get silted up, they're more difficult to clean. They'll crush pretty easily. There are a variety of issues with the corrugated pipe, and so if you and plus it's, I just prefer working with the rigid.
Yeah.
So that would be my advice on that.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much, John, for calling. I want to give some others a chance to get in here. Jim in Menominee up next. Jim, hello to you.
Hello. I heard you talking about residential-sized wind generators a few minutes ago, and since I've had some experience with that, we've been using a small wind generator to produce a significant part of our electrical needs since 1977. So the equipment's available, it works, it's not cheap. However, the vertical type of things that look like cones or cylinders that mount on your roof have not been shown to work.
Okay.
Those are basically ornamental things. There's dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of companies out there promoting those. As far as I know, only one or two of them have actually had them tested by any kind of reputable testing means. They just don't work that close to the ground.
Yeah.
The first thing a person has to remember if they're going to put in any kind of a wind generator system is that it needs to be up in the air where the wind is more consistent and comes, you know, more from one direction where there's less turbulence. So as a basic rule of thumb, you're talking about something being at least 30 feet higher than anything within 500 feet of it in any direction.
Oh.
So in Wisconsin, you see lots of wind generators on 100 or 120-foot towers of the smaller home-sized units. And that's when they're in a fairly clear place, you know, out in the middle of a field, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Jim, you're agreeing, I think, with what I was saying, and there's a lot of things to consider, and that's why you really should have someone who knows how to take a look at site assessment and
there are certified site assessors that work through, I think they're certified by the MREA is one of the places,
correct.
The Midwest Renewable Energy Association, and they work through Focus on Energy and do site assessments so that, you know, if you want to have a wind generator at your place, the best thing to do is go out and spend that $600 or so that a site assessment costs. You get a site visit, and probably a week later you're going to get a written report with more information you can imagine needing, including, you know, what the wind is like at your place, what kind of a tower you need, and what kind of generators are available that might meet your needs.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe the site assessor would say, you don't have a good site, you shouldn't do this.
Yeah. I thank you very much for calling, and Dave, you pretty much agree with that then as well.
Absolutely. There's it sounds very nice to have wind generators and solar panels, but until you really deal with the nuts and bolts of these pieces of equipment and what their costs are, you haven't really got a realistic evaluation of how it fits into your scheme of things.
Thanks, Jim, for calling. I appreciate it very much. Eileen emailed us and says we're in need of replacing two flat roofs. One is flat and above the front porch. The other has a slight pitch, 1-3. And is above an addition. Is it best to use the rubber membrane, or is it safe to use the newer technique of layering on a poured material that dries and seals? She's wondering which one might last longer on this 1890s home.
Well, I'm not too sure about what she's referring to with the pour-on and seal approach. It is possible to use to have a tar roof on a flat roof that is a poured tar or applied tar mixture, and sometimes gravel is laid into that. You know, that can be effective. Rubber membranes are considered kind of the standard best practice now for a relatively flat roof. You definitely have to avoid a shingled material on a flat roof, though there are some approaches you can take with a roll roofing. So I think it really comes down to finding a competent installer and, you know, going with their expertise for the particular home.
John in Port Wing has a home with a small attic converted to a sleeping space. It has short knee walls and a steeply sloped ceiling, and the insulation is very poor. Rafters were insulated before the sheetrock was put up, but was poorly done and has suffered from rodent damage. Can foam be used to mitigate some of this problem, or does it need to be totally stripped and redone? Probably hard to say without looking at it, but...
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's probably going to have to be stripped. It's really hard to properly insulate that sort of a structure without getting into it. And certainly going to what we call a hot roof is a possibility, where a foam is applied, a spray foam is applied onto the roof deck from the inside and completely seals up the envelope of the home down to the top plates of the walls. And so that attic space could be very comfortably insulated and sealed, but it often has to be done prior to the finished material going up. Though, you know, there are circumstances where if there is an attic space above that that is accessible, a combination of dense packing and air sealing can be done. And, you know, we certainly do that sort of a retrofit in a number of bungalow-style homes. So,
let's turn to Myrtle in Madison now. Myrtle, hi. Thank you for calling.
And thank you for taking my call. I have a four-season porch on a slab, and I have a glued-on carpet that I'm removing. And I wonder if there's a product to place over the slab for insulation, and what do you recommend for a slab covering?
How much do you have room to put some down there, or is it...
Do I have room? Pardon
me? Do you have room, once you take off the carpeting, to put some insulation down and raise the floor?
Well, it depends upon how much room it would take up, how many inches.
Minimum of a couple inches.
Couple inches.
Yeah, minimum of a couple inches. In other words, your thresholds, how would that fit in your doorway out of the four-season porch?
Okay. I have steps going down. The porch is lower than the rest of the house.
Okay. Well, yeah. Then you don't have any problem, I don't think.
Yeah, you should be able to add some rigid foam board that would be placed onto the slab, and then you can typically float a layer of plywood as kind of the new subfloor, and then cover that over with your carpet or some other material. The only thing you have to worry about in a situation like that, I assume if it's four season, it's not being rained on.
No, it isn't.
Okay,
no.
So...
Yeah. Would you have to take that carpet off that's glued down to the floor if you're going to do that?
I guess I'd do it because it is providing some kind of insulation, and it just may not make sense to leave down there, though. It could be there for rodents underneath. I would take it up just...
Okay.
So that you're building onto a solid foundation,
okay.
Meaning your concrete.
Okay.
Okay, and then what would you recommend for a new covering over that? I'm trying to move away from the carpet.
Well, what type of floor would you like to have out there?
Well, I've seen some of these new, the advertisements for these cement coverings that you can, I don't know what it is, but they spray it on or...
Well, the thing, I mean, you're going to be doing away with the cement because you're going to be building up on top of it. So
but there isn't anything similar, you know, that would be a thin covering to go over the top of it. Just stick to another carpet.
Well, you could put down a sheet material like a linoleum product or vinyl flooring product. Mm-hmm. I mean, something like that could be done. I would discourage you from doing anything like a ceramic tile, because
okay.
There will be some resilience to the foam board underneath everything, and you're likely to see cracks in the grout lines. It's just not likely to be solid enough, though things can be done to actually make it rigid enough for that, but it's just it's all in the details.
You could also put on manufactured wood flooring, too.
Oh, that sounds good. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, and Dave Kenyon of the Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation, our guests here today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in our conversation today as we talk home renovation and repair, The number, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And we'll turn to Jeff in Winneconne next. Jeff, hello.
Yes, I was driving up 45, and I seen a nice little windmill on top of a shack. I stopped in, and I said, "What do you got here?" And he said, "I've got a 400-watt windmill I bought from West Allis Tool, Industrial Tool, for $4.99, and it runs four appliances in my house. He runs... you know, a 100-watt heater, a toaster, and you can buy the 1,000-watters too, and they're $1,000. That's enough to do your pretty much your whole house if you're, you know, smart enough to, you know, cut down on a few things. That's West Allis Tool, Industrial Tool is where you can buy these. You just plug them in. There's no transformers or anything else like that.
Hmm. Well, Dave, have you ever heard of those?
I have not heard of those. That's one I would have to take to some friends who know more about renewable energy than I do.
So, West Allis, huh?
West Allis Industrial Tool. You just plug them in. The 400-watter I'm going to hook up to the house. It's a little plastic deal. John Deere is building their new plant in Indiana on two of those. That's all they use.
Hmm. Jeff, you must be talking about a standalone system, because as soon as you start putting it into your electrical system, it's a totally different...
That's correct.
...kettle of fish.
That's correct, yes.
Well, thanks for the information. Appreciate it, Jeff. And I'm going to take a look online at it myself and see what's there. Let's turn to Paul in Duluth next. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I hope I have a real easy one for these guys. I live in a older cabin on the North Shore, Lake Superior, and I've lived here a long time, but I've never had cause to go up in the attic. I've got one of those fold-down stairways, and I decided I was going to store some items up there, so I dropped down that thing and went up there, and I noticed that on both ends of the building, there are these relatively small, they're like, oh, probably 6x8 openings that are covered with a screen, but there's a door to open and close that air thing. What do I do with those? Should they be open or closed at different times of the year, or... I don't even know what the purpose of them is. I can't say I've ever even seen one before.
Yeah, every now and then we'll get into a home and we'll find these doors up on the gable vents. And I think there was a time when people thought that, well, you know, the venting is really being done in the summertime to keep the heat down in the attic. And so I want to preface this by saying this was... I would recommend you don't close the door, and that maybe you could remove the door.
Well, they're open. And they can open and close. So.
Right, and I think there was a time when people thought they should shut those in the wintertime because it's so cold. And the irony of that is that ventilation of the attic in the winter is probably... the most critical time.
I was concerned about moisture buildup.
Correct. And so that's why I can't really envision an appropriate time to close that vent. But I think that's what was behind the door at one time. And so I would say just don't close the door, and, you know, secure it in an open position so it doesn't accidentally close. Are there other vents up in the attic?
Not really, but I'll tell you what I've noticed is that it's got blown foam insulation up there, and literally when the wind blows really hard, which it's prone to do around here, these fine pellets of styrofoam rain down in various corners of the building.
Whoa.
Well, I mean, it's unbelievable what happened. They form like little windrows. And my, you know, I'm a renter, and I've told my landlord about it. He doesn't seem to have any interest in dealing with it. But that's what happens, and that's why I thought maybe in the wintertime I should be closing those. And I don't know.
All right, Chad.
Do you pay for the heat?
I will be starting this summer. Up until now, I haven't. It was included in my rent, but beginning this summer, I'll be responsible for my propane.
Well,
I'm getting jerked around, but I love living here, so I put up with it.
Yeah, I would say it's awfully thoughtful of you to be concerned about the doors in the house that you don't own, you know, because actually the issue of keeping the attic ventilated in the wintertime is one that's going to degrade the home if it's not properly ventilated. But since you don't own the place, and if in fact it's causing a nuisance.
Well, my vacuum picks it up, but it's just, tells me that I'm losing insulation in the attic.
I'd say one thing you may want to consider is blowing in some cellulose or something over what sounds like...
It's real fine particles of...
Styrofoam or something
like
that?
Yeah, they're little beads.
Yeah, little beads of styrofoam. We want to keep those in place somehow. And so maybe some a couple inches of... cellulose blown in over that would keep it in place, and you'd have a much better surface there to deal with the ventilation that's going to occur in the rest of the attic.
It is, though, an opportunity to say that a lot of times we do find that in homes, even homes built today, that if proper damming is not done on the soffits, that the loose fill insulation will get blown around in an attic. And it's important to try to prevent that from happening while at the same time providing adequate ventilation for an attic space.
Thank you so much. I didn't think it was this complicated.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And John and Matt Hudson, we'll turn to you now. Hi, John.
Hi. See, I have a plumbing water pressure question.
Okay.
I have a 20-year-old home. I have two baths, one up, one down. I have a well, and I also have a horse barn. The water pressure to the horse barn is very good, but if I'm running my shower and somebody flushes a toilet, my pressure drops quite a bit, and I'm wondering what could I do to increase my water pressure?
I have no idea. I'm sorry.
You must be on a well, then?
Yes, I'm on a well.
Yeah, there should be a pressure setting on your well in terms of the pressure that is attained in the pressure tank.
Yes.
If you are drawing water, if you have a low pressure in that pressure tank and you're drawing water off it at a pretty quick rate, you don't have much pressure to go if it's too low. So you... you know, what I'm suggesting is that you raise, if possible, raise the pressure in the pressure tank.
Raise the pressure setting then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I think you may need to talk to a professional well person on this too, because it may be a matter of size of pressure tank too. It may not be just a matter of the pressure, but it may be the quantity of water under pressure.
Yeah. Well, you might have to get a 30-gallon or a 40-gallon instead of a 25-gallon, something like that, you mean?
Again, yes. Talk with a plumber who has experience with wells, I would suggest.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jay in Hancock wonders if you could comment about the energy efficiency of a fireplace insert. I know our fireplace probably wastes energy as the heat from the house goes up the chimney, but how much better is an insert? Does it just waste less energy, or is there the possibility of saving on home heating costs?
Inserts can be very efficient. They can be not efficient. What you're looking for, if you can afford it and if you can find it, is a closed combustion unit. If it's running on natural gas, they're all closed combustion units. But if they're solid fuel or wood burning, then you really need to take a look at the units, because just think of it: if you don't have closed combustion, you're using house air for that combustion, so you're taking that conditioned air and it's going right up the chimney, and that's where you lose a lot of your efficiency.
Makes good sense to me. And we have a gas, and it's great. Mm-hmm. It's really nice, especially in the fall before you want to turn the furnace on, but you want a little, get the edge off.
Get the chill off.
Get the chill off. Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, one of our guests. The other, Dave Kenyon, is with the Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation. They'll be with us up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking home renovation, repair, and energy issues with Chad Spade of Chad's Carpentry and Dave Kenyon of the Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation. Lots of callers online, and I think we'll just go right to the phones here. Mac in Land O'Lakes, we turn to you. Hi, Mac. Thank you for calling.
Got a question about what they think about rubber roofing. I want to put one on a roof here that's got a 5-pitch section and a 3.5-pitch. The shingles on the 3.5-pitch just curled up over the last years, and the 5-pitch stayed okay. I'm just wondering what they think about rubber roofing in general. It also has skylights in it.
Well, generally, when you have a pitch of 3.12 or greater, you can use a traditional shingle, and rubber roofing is really typically for a 2-pitch or less. And curling is often a symptom of heat being trapped under the roof, or there could be excessive moisture that's not getting out, and it's leading to this problem. And that is something that probably needs to be dealt with by better ventilation of the attic in that area. Is there ventilation in the 3.5-pitch area?
Yeah, it's just airspace, because the inside is a cathedral ceiling, sort of. And the ceiling is about 11 inches below the roof. There is insulation in there, but there is also airspace with vents on the top and the bottom of the roof.
Okay. And then what is the material on the ceiling?
Wood.
Like a tongue and groove paneling?
Yes.
Okay. So what's...
No, it's not paneling. It's actually wood.
Right. I'm sorry. So you have the tongue and groove planks that are up there, and perhaps there's bat insulation, like fiberglass bat insulation behind that. And so what's probably happening is a lot of air is leaking through that assembly. And, if in a perfect world that air would not be leaking through it, and if it does, it would be taken care of by the ventilation that's designed into the system. But it could be that just given the would the direction of the roof face with the on the site combined with the way moisture and air are passing through it are contributing to that roof failure. And while rubber is not going to fail in the same way, I'm not familiar with using rubber in a situation like that. I think you might want to consider dealing with making it more airtight and making sure that the ventilation is in fact unobstructed underneath that roof deck.
Okay.
All right, sir.
All right, thank you very much for calling.
Very good.
Teddy in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Teddy.
Hi, I've told my husband that I would give you a call. You're my best bet for asking questions. We have a shake roof, and we've been in the house 22 years. And my husband said, and we looked at it going, should we replace the roof? I just want to know, what is the longevity of a shake roof?
That's a good question. I mean, it does. Have you periodically had it resealed?
We've never had it resealed.
Okay, well, that I would recommend that you contact a contractor that specializes in cleaning and resealing a shake roof, because a shake roof, a lot like a shake home or a wood-sided home, I mean, it just requires some maintenance. It should last a long time if cared for. And it could be that you find that because nothing's been done to it, that it has really maybe gone past the point of being restored. But there are products that can be applied to the cedar that will help restore its moisture content and to help protect it. I mean, you know, of course, cedar is a naturally weather and pest resistant, or I should say rot resistant material.
Mm-hmm.
But it does require sealants typically to be able to last as long as it should. For example, I know this is a little off topic, but if you put in a cedar deck, it's very, or railings, it's very important that you stain it and treat it. And the same applies for a roof. It used to be that we thought you could just put cedar out and let it weather and that nothing needed to be done to it. And the truth of the matter is that UV damage has gotten worse over the last few decades, and it is further degrading wood surfaces, as well as contributing to other things, that's why it's really critical that something be done to restore it and protect it.
Okay.
But hopefully it'll last many more decades.
Oh, good.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Teddy. Thank you for calling. And Craig in Onalaska, you are next. Hi, Craig.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. My question is on flooring. I've got a walkout, and my dogs, which I have three, are allowed only downstairs. And we currently have carpet. The house is about 15 years old, and I'm thinking of replacing the carpet. And I'm trying to think and find a product that would be really resilient against dogs, you know, scratching it up when they run. And I'd like to have something other than carpet because of the shedding problem that I have with the labs. So do your people have any ideas?
Okay.
First thing that comes to my mind is something like tile.
It's over in the, like I say, it's a walkout. So the carpet that we have, you know, it does give some extra insulation during the winter.
Yeah.
So there was an insulation put under the slab when the house was built?
That I don't know.
Well, I would agree. I mean, almost anything that you put down. Of course, we talked earlier about the possibility of, you know, adding some insulation and then a new subfloor and then doing something on top of that. But if I don't know what else you could
do. We have tile in our entryway, and I just love it. So in terms of keeping it clean and having it look nice all the time, it just really is nice.
Okay, but you're not aware of any manufactured wooden floors that are really resilient?
They're going to get scratched up.
Yeah, they're going to get scratched up, even the manufactured wooden floors. Yep.
Okay, so it's either carpet or tile or linoleum.
Or linoleum.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for your help.
Yep.
And I would recommend that you get a commercial grade linoleum because that's what you're going to need to deal with the wear and tear of those claws.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good.
Thanks, Greg. And let's see. We're going to go to Barrett. Is that correct? Do I have your name right?
Yes, it is.
Thank you for calling.
Okay. I have a question. I live in an old cottage, and it needs to be insulated, you know, newer insulation. And I would also like to do new windows. My question then is, what do I do first?
Okay.
How old is the cottage?
It's in 1924.
Okay. What has the wiring been updated?
What is that?
Well, the electrical wiring.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Yes. Because one thing that we always have to be concerned about in an old building like that is if it has knob and tube wiring, we don't want to ever fill up the walls with insulation when there is old knob and tube wiring. So if you confirm that there isn't any knob and tube wiring, then... I'm not sure, really, that one thing has to be done before the other if you're just looking to dense pack the walls of the cottage. If you were looking at residing and adding some foam insulation on the exterior under that new siding, then it would make sense for that to happen in conjunction with the windows being replaced, because there's some flashing details that are more easily done when those are done together.
I wasn't planning to do that.
Okay.
Cedar, the cottage has cedar on the outside.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That you want to keep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would add one thing, and that is that to the ceiling of your cottage, not only must you think about the walls, but you also have to think about the ceiling and the air sealing of that attic, because your heat goes out the top a lot of times.
Right. Okay.
All right.
The last thing I would add is just typically on payback, a well air-sealed and insulated retrofit of the home is going to have a lot better payback long-term than replacing the windows. So if you're just assessing cost to value of energy savings, that is one bit of advice I'd give you, is to do the insulating first, and then you'll be saving money more quickly on your energy bill to help pay for those windows.
Oh, okay. Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for calling. And Steve in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. Yes, I just have a question about staining the fence and the railing on a deck, not the decking itself. I'm not going to do that, but it's a 5-year-old condominium, and it's really peeling.
Hold on just a second. We had a little issue here that I'm going to try and take care of. Now I think I have it taken care of. Are you?
Oh, you there, Larry?
Yeah, we lost you there for a second, but we're okay now. I'm sorry. Start over again.
Okay, so it's about staining the railings and on a deck. I'm not going to do the deck itself, but just the railings and also an adjoining fence. And I'm looking at the new Consumer Reports. They came out with some decking, and they recommend a different brand than what the original contractor used. And I'm just wondering about switching brands. It'd be a solid, stain. Is there a problem with that, or?
And what is the? Is it an oil-based stain, or is it?
It doesn't really say. I'm not sure.
Most exterior stains are, but.
It could be acrylic these days, too.
Right, right. The primary issue will be compatibility of the products. And so if you have the original product, what I would recommend is that you talk to the retailer where you're going to be purchasing the new stain and, find someone there who, can help give you some advice on whether or not it's appropriate to cover one product over another.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're gonna need to get some. Make sure that you talk to somebody who knows and is able to judge that.
Mm-hmm.
And or you can do like me and take your deck off and make a stone patio. And I got so tired of staining the patio and the decks. I just got mad and got rid of the whole thing and put in a stone floor. Oh man. Good luck, Steve. Thanks for calling. Ruth in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, how are you? Nice to talk to you.
Thanks for calling.
I have a problem with ice buildup in my gutters that I thought I had solved by installing a heater cord throughout the gutter. And I was much surprised last winter when I saw one little drop starting going down my wall inside my living room. And I thought, well, I've got to go out to the hardware store and buy a new heating unit, and he said, you have to check your electrical connections because you probably have an extension cord. And so I'm wondering if I just electric tape up all my electrical connections, which would be basically one, I guess, if that'll do, or if plugging it into the outside outlet of the house itself is a problem.
Well, do you know whether or not the heat tape was actually working? Or
well, yeah, because I went, I just, he said, I'm not going to sell you anything. He's a great guy, because he wasn't going to sell me something I didn't need. So I went home, and I took apart the connection to the heating unit itself and blew on it, blew all the water out, and sure enough, there was a little water in there. And I also pulled the outlet by the house and kind of blew into that and blew out some excess water, and then it worked. So I'm just wondering if that just having that outside outlet, if I'm going to have to maintain that all year, or if I can tape it up somehow and make it safer.
Well, is it a ground fault outlet outside?
I'm a single mom. No, I'm 53 years old. I was never trained in that kind of thing. It's just I got a regular, 1960s square ranch house, and it's got an outlet on the outside I plug it into.
Okay.
Is it a three-prong?
Two.
Two-prong.
It's got two outlets in the box, but the prong is three, yes.
Is there a little button inside there that you can, it says test on one of them and then a reset button?
I'm afraid
button?
I'm not that updated.
Okay. Well, I mean,
just a really standard, fits the two plugs. There's no other buttons in there.
Well, it's really important that an exterior outlet be ground fault interrupted. And what that is a safety device that will trip off the power to the plug in the event that there is a short circuit. And if there is water in the outlet, then that's dangerous. I mean, I'm bringing this up more because of concern for your safety, because you want that type of an outlet. And I would recommend that you have a licensed electrician check the outlet and perhaps upgrade it if that's necessary. It'll be a relatively inexpensive thing, but that's an important first step in having safe and reliable power for the heat tape. And then I would say that it's important to make sure that heat tape runs down below the outlet before it heads back up into the downspout and up to the gutters, because then the water will drip off of the heat tape below the outlet and not be threatening a short.
Is there a plastic cover on your outlet outside?
They have the snap closures for when you're not using them, but that's probably not what you're talking about.
So it's like a metal box.
It's a metal, yeah.
Oh, no.
Oh, it's not? Okay.
No.
I'd have that looked at. I'm just a little concerned about the safety of it. And
well,
then
that does bring me to a second question about money. Single mom, teenager, three part-time jobs, and student, and really low on funds. Do you have like a government energy-saving website you could send me to?
For something like that, I don't know. Dave, is there anything that comes to your mind?
The only possibility that I can think of is the low-income weatherization program, and that you'd need to call, I don't have the numbers here, but you'd need to call them to see if you qualify.
And was that local or state?
It's a statewide low-income weatherization program, but it's delivered through local nonprofits. They're mainly looking at insulation and energy issues, but they will do a certain number of safety issues as well.
So if I do a search for weatherization low-income, I might find it?
That's correct.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, the other option is fixing the problem so that you don't have the ice damming issue to begin with. And for that, if insulation or whatever, you were talking about that earlier, Chad.
Well, right. And I know in Madison, Project Home is involved in helping with low-income houses and doing that sort of air sealing and insulating, and they would probably, I don't know whether or not they would assist with that outlet, for example, but there are, I think, other programs, and I would say, I don't know if Project Home exists in Milwaukee, but I'm sure something comparable to it does, and so I would recommend that you seek out that assistance, and you should be able to be connected to qualified people will help do it.
And then you could forget about the heat tape altogether.
Yeah,
that's the whole point.
One thing you might Google is La Casa. They're one of the weatherization agencies in the Milwaukee area, but I can't tell you whether they serve your particular location.
Right, and maybe my alderman could help.
Yes.
Yep. Okay.
Sounds good.
Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot, Ruth, for calling, and good luck.
Mm-hmm.
We have Mike in Menominee, Michigan, next. Hi, Mike.
Oh, hi, Larry. Your guest, Chad and Dave. Thanks for taking my call. I have an HVAC question for you.
Okay.
I bought a new house 2 years ago, and it's finished. Both floors are finished, plaster and carpeting. In the winter, there's a 6-degree differential in temperature from the upper level to the lower level,
mm-hmm.
so that the lower level is uninhabitable. And I have a standard furnace. The house only has one thermostat on the upper level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we set the thermostat. It's fine on the upper level. The temperature is just what the thermostat reads. But on the lower level, it's 6 degrees difference.
Mm-hmm.
What should I do?
Warm air rises, and whenever you have your situation where you have one thermostat trying to take care of both levels, there is going to be a difference in temperature. One of the options you may want to think about is to zone the house where the lower level is separately zoned from upstairs, and that means you'll have a separate thermostat down there. If you go that route, you probably want to have some kind of doorway or something, closure between the two, because otherwise your heat's just going to be heading up top and you could get it too warm upstairs.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that you could do, which will require a little bit of tinkering, but you can utilize dampers that are either at the supply grill in each room, where the heat's blowing out. You can damper things there, and better yet, if it's possible to damper the system down in the basement or wherever the furnace is located, to help push more of the heat to the lower level in the wintertime. The only thing I would say is that come summer, you're going to essentially reverse that, but that would be a less expensive way to try to mitigate the problem.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Chad and Dave, thank you so much as well. I wanted to remind our listeners in the Bayfield area, if you're in Bayfield tomorrow or in the within a good driving distance, come visit me. This afternoon I'll be driving to Bayfield, and we'll be broadcasting our Garden Talk show from the Bayfield Pavilion right on the shores of Lake Superior. It's going to be a lot of fun, and no charge to come, and there'll be lots of exhibits, and we're going to have a ball. So, and that's come at before 11, come at 10:30, and we'd love to have you there. And Chad and Dave, Chad's the owner of Chad's Carpentry. Go to chadscarpentry.com, and for Dave's website, wecc.org. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.